We're working our way through the Bible, talking about book by book, and today we have arrived at 2 Samuel. As you've been able to tell by now, the Old Testament is a collection of rich stories. Some of those stories have been lifting our spirits, and some of them have been leaving us in despair. In other words, the Old Testament is a mirror of real life. Now, 2 Samuel, I have to warn you this morning, is pretty much of a downer. It particularly forces us to take a look at the dark side of family life and of politics. Now, you might say that 2 Samuel should maybe be even R-rated or X-rated because it does include 16 cold-blooded murders and the rapes of 12 women and numerous wars and gruesome battles and a couple of genocides. The reality of 2 Samuel is more like today than we want to admit. It's consolidated evil. At least in our day-to-day lives, we can turn on a comedy or distract ourselves with commercials or talk about the weather or get some sort of a break. But when we're reading 2 Samuel straight through, we get no break. It all comes at us. And as we're reading the book of 2 Samuel, I want to caution, however, that it is not simply a book of miserable plot lines. It is also a book that yields deep insight into human character, and it offers us an amazing amount of wisdom when it comes to dealing with the dysfunction of our families and the dysfunction of our politics. It's not a pleasant read, but it's a powerful one for us. As we're reading through the book of 2 Samuel, very quickly we note that there are three main characters that are found in that book. Of course, at the center of the book is King David. He begins to rule in 2 Samuel, the passage that I read for you, and he is the king of Israel throughout the remainder of 2 Samuel. The second main character of that book is Absalom, one of David's sons. And the third major character of 2 Samuel is Joab, who is the military commander of David's army. Those three people occupy most of the book of 2 Samuel. David, Absalom, his son, Joab, his military commander. Now, last week we talked about how good David was. We're not going to talk about that today. Because David and his son Absalom are responsible for 11 of the 12 rapes that occur in the book of 2 Samuel. I don't have much good to say about David today. David and Absalom are responsible for 11 of the 12 rapes that occur. David is responsible for 9 of the 16 cold-blooded murders that occur in the book of 2 Samuel. Joab, David's general, is responsible for 4 of those cold-blooded murders, doing 3 of them with himself with his own knife or sword. And Absalom, David's son, is responsible for 1 of the cold-blooded murders that occur. It is at the beginning of 2 Samuel that David becomes the king of all Israel, and he consolidates his power by having his opponents killed. He also conquers the city of Jerusalem, which is known forevermore as the city of David, by killing a number of residents there, and he establishes his capital there in Jerusalem. And it is in the book of 2 Samuel that David mentions that he wants to build God a temple in Jerusalem. And God does not think this is such a good idea and passes that message on to David. God's take on it is this: look, I'm, you know, like the creator of the universe, and you think somehow you're doing something because you're going to build me a house to live in? And God, of course, recognized that some of the thinking behind building a temple is, you know, if we can just box God in, if we could just define God. And so God sends a very clear message to David: no, I don't want you to build me a house. And David follows what God wants in that instance and doesn't build a house. Now, what God does do, he says to David, I'm going to build you a house, however. Not a actual physical house, but a house in the sense of a political dynasty. And God says to David, I'm going to build you a house, and your descendants are going to rule God's people into perpetuity. Now, so it was a house as in a political dynasty. Like if you go to Massachusetts, the House of the Kennedys, or earlier in American history, the House of the Adams, or if you go to Chicago, the House of Daley, you know, where you just have one generation after another. And that's what God says to David. I will make you a house, as in a political dynasty. And we see here the beginning of what we call in the Old Testament the Davidic covenant. Now, it may sound a little academic, but I want to press the point just a little bit for you because it's important for us when we think about God. There are two basic types of covenant that are made in the Old Testament. One is a covenant God makes with Moses, and the other is a covenant God makes with David. Now, the covenant with Moses is a covenant that goes like this. You know, God is good and holy, and it's our job to imitate God. And if we imitate God in God's goodness and holiness, then God is going to bless us, and we're going to experience an increase of goodness in our own lives. That's the Mosaic covenant. The more we can be good and holy like God, the more God is going to give us rewards for that and blessings for that. The Davidic covenant, on the other hand, says this, that God's love will continue in our lives no matter what we do. That there's nothing we can do that will totally take God's love away from us. And so in the Old Testament now, we see here in 2 Samuel the expression of that second type of covenant. Now, both of these covenants, the covenant that says if we try to be like God in God's goodness and God's holiness and obey the commandments, that will be blessed for that, the Mosaic covenant and the Davidic covenant, both of these will find their fullest and most mature expression when we get to the New Testament. And it's important for us to understand both of these covenants. If we have one without the other, we're going to have a very distorted idea of what it means to relate to God and what it means to be God's people. And so in the New Testament, we're going to see the Mosaic covenant continue to be expressed in places like the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus lays on us some things we need to do and ways we need to be responsible. But we're also going to see the Davidic covenant find its most mature expression in Paul's writings, where Paul particularly says, you know, there's nothing that can separate us from the love of Christ, and where Paul writes about grace. So both of these, but it's in 2 Samuel that we see the emergence for the first time of the Davidic covenant. It is in 2 Samuel that David, King David, becomes a peeping Tom. He discovers his neighbor's wife, Bathsheba, bathing. He sends for her. He rapes her. And when she becomes pregnant, he tries to cover it up. And when the cover-up doesn't work, he has Bathsheba's husband killed, and he takes her for his own wife. It is in 2 Samuel that we see the old adage, like father, like son. David's oldest son, Amnon, works up an uncontrollable lust for his half-sister, Tamar, and after a time, he rapes her. When David learns what his son has done to his daughter, David does nothing. The girl's brother, full brother, Absalom, however, is full of rage, decides to take matters into his own hands, and after waiting, seething in revenge for 2 years, arranges for the cold-blooded murder of Amnon, his half-brother, who raped his full sister. Now, all through 2 Samuel, no one seems to be particularly concerned about the woman who was raped, Tamar. And in that book, she simply disappears into obscurity, suffering what appears to be a lifelong depression. The story in 2 Samuel is all about the men and their runaway testosterone. Men who are more interested in fighting for their make-believe honor than they are in justice and restoration for those who have been assaulted. It sounds a lot like today's news. Now, Absalom is not only angry at his half-brother Amnon for the rape of his sister, but he's also angry at his father David for doing nothing, and he's angry at David for other things, and he decides that the best way to get back at his father for doing nothing about the rape is to rape his father's 10 concubines. And so a tent is set up on top of the palace where everybody can see, and Absalom proceeds to rape his father's concubines. This is an act that is concurrent with Absalom's attempt to also overtake David and take on the throne for himself and have his father murdered. There's a huge civil war that takes place in the middle of 2 Samuel between thousands of soldiers who have decided to cast their lot with Absalom and thousands of other soldiers who decide that David probably will be the victor. And in this civil war, David's soldiers are victorious and they kill David's son Absalom in the course of the battle. Now, here's the thing about David. While David was capable of raping and murdering others in cold blood without a twinge of conscience, he had a blind spot when it came to his sons. Not his daughters, his sons. And you see, David was unable to really see anything his sons had done wrong. And if he did see it, he always turned a blind eye to it. A case of a parent not able to confront the problems of their adult children. David turns a blind eye to the failures of his sons. And when David's son Absalom is killed in a battle, even though it was a battle where Absalom was trying to kill David and overtake David's throne, when Absalom is killed, the only thing that David can do is wail about the death of his sons, and he even is not able to thank the soldiers who have defended him and his thrones. He's just consumed with his own family situation. The best encapsulation of 2 Samuel comes near the end of the book in chapter 22 where David offers a prayer of thanks to God. It is the worst prayer in the Bible. It goes on and on where David thanks God for all of the bloody victories that God has given him over the years. And it's all about me, 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 as David prays. And in that prayer, in the course of 34 verses, David uses the words me, myself, and I, or I, 94 times. It's a prayer where it's all about David. The book of 2 Samuel ends with a collection of sins and plagues and famines and hangings and stabbings. End of 2 Samuel. Now, we've been asking three questions about each of these books as we've been going through. What's the bad news? What's the good news? What's the practical application? The hardest thing about 2 Samuel is trying to figure out which bad news to try to lift up here. But as I was reading it, it seemed pretty clear to me. The bad news in 2 Samuel is all the violence against all the women. And maybe 2 Samuel wouldn't be such bad news if we didn't have that problem anymore. But we do still have that problem. And that's what makes 2 Samuel so disturbing to read it in the light of what's happening in our country and in the light of what's happening in our world today. In the world today, every year, 50,000 women are killed by someone in their own family, usually their own husband. 50,000 women a year killed by a family member. In the United States, every year, 1,200 women are killed by someone they live with. In the United States, 600 women a day are raped. 600 a day. And every day in the United States, 60 girls who are 11 years old and under are raped. Every day in the United States, 60 girls 11 years old and under. In the world today, 20 million women and children are in slavery. We think slavery does not exist anymore after the Civil War. Not true. We need to open our eyes. 20 million girls and women live in slavery today. They cannot get free. And most of that is due to the sex trade industry. And 20 million girls and women, and many of these show up on porn sites that are seen in the United States, fueling that industry. Worldwide, 9 million adolescent girls are raped every year. In the world, over 200 million women bear the marks of forced genital mutilation. Women worldwide are increasingly becoming victims of cyber harassment. And once your name or once your image, doctored as it may be, goes on the internet, there's no way to get it off. Every day in the United States, every single day, there are 10,000 instances of domestic violence, physical or psychological. Every day in our country, supposedly a Christian country, 10,000 incidents of domestic violence every single day. Now, some people say they don't like the Old Testament, but by God, at least the Old Testament tells us a truth that Christians need to be looking at. And it's right there staring us in the face in 2 Samuel. I hesitated to go into this because, you know, maybe a preacher should gloss over this sort of stuff. Maybe a preacher shouldn't talk about what's really in the Bible. But I thought, well, you know, it's Lent. We're supposed to be in a season of facing our sin. And I don't pound the pulpit very often about sin. But I don't know any way to talk faithfully about 2 Samuel without raising these issues. So what's the good news of 2 Samuel? Well, the fact is the book does have good news. It's not a shallow book. As I said earlier, it's not just a one miserable plot line after another. The book of 2 Samuel is very carefully crafted. It's a very rich and powerful and insightful book. And one of the things that we see all the way through 2 Samuel is that nobody who mistreats other people ever gets a free pass. It doesn't matter if you're the king of Israel. You do something wrong, you get confronted for it. And one of the things that's amazing is all the way through the book of 2 Samuel, people speak up and they say what has to be said. They don't say it in the poisonous political partisan way that people accuse each other these days. But all the way through 2 Samuel, there are thoughtful people. They see what's going on. And they say what needs to be said, and they speak the truth to people who are powerful and who could execute them in cold blood, as happens in 2 Samuel. That's the good news of 2 Samuel. All the people who see what's going on, and they say what they have to say. And they do make a difference. They don't stop all of the stuff that's going on. But that's an incredible thing in 2 Samuel. It's the first time we see that in the Bible, where people of wisdom and thoughtfulness and courage speak up and say what has to be said. That's encouraging to me as I read through the book of 2 Samuel. We're also asking the question, what are the practical applications of the book? And there are two things that I want to lift for your attention about 2 Samuel. First of all, how can David be so evil in 2 Samuel when he was so good in 1 Samuel? How can somebody so bad, as we read through 2 Samuel, have written so many of these wonderful psalms? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie. How can somebody so evil do so much good? How can somebody so evil in the writings of 2 Samuel be somebody who's talked about so favorably in the New Testament? In fact, be held up as a model for Jesus. How could that happen? And one of the things that 2 Samuel forces us to come to the realization is that there's some very fascinating literary things that are happening in the Bible. And if we take a look at what's going on in a literary sense between 1 Samuel, where David's a hero, and 2 Samuel, where David's a villain, and we bring those two together, we bring these two pieces of literature together, 1 and 2 Samuel, so opposite in so many ways. One of the things that we realize is that, in a sense, while David is written up in terms of full of hyperbole and exaggeration, he does represent the truth about all of us. Because all of us have good and all of us have bad. All of us have a light side and all of us have a dark side. That's what it means to be human. We read about that in the book of Genesis. Every human being, like the first human being, is made of breath of God and dirt. That's what it means to be human. We are all that. There's not a single one of us that escapes the dirt part of who we are. That's a theme of Lent. But also, there's not a single one of us that has been created in the image of God with the breath of God. Now, in a literary sense, when we bring 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel together, what we see in the life of David is this: David is us. In maybe ways that are more exaggerated than we want to live our lives, but the truth is there. That for each of us, there's a dark side. There's a side that can be very selfish and that can harm other people without thinking. And in each of us, there also is a good side. And one of the things that we learn as we read through 1 and 2 Samuel is that it doesn't edify us at all to make a hero out of somebody or to make a demon out of somebody. It only edifies us when we can look at other people and understand their complexity as human beings. Now, whether it's the church or whether it's the politics that we have, we're really big these days into either demonizing people or making idols of people. And the Bible won't let us do that, particularly when we try to read 1 and 2 Samuel together. The only way we can be edified is by understanding people, not by idolizing them or demonizing them. Either book read by itself is gonna lead us astray. We've got to have 1 and 2 Samuel together. Now, the second thing, that's a practical application of the book. How important it is not to demonize or idolize anyone. Second practical application I'd like to offer you of the book has to do with what it means to demand justice of people who have done wrong. Now, this is particularly an issue today, whether it's in our churches or whether it's in our politics. And it's interesting, in the light of 2 Samuel having to do so much with how women are mistreated, that it's such a part of our debate today. What do we do about reports that the president has done something wrong in regard to women? What do we do about reports that the former vice president has done something wrong? Later today, when I send my Sunday letter out on the email version, I'm going to write on that topic. But how do we deal with issues of justice? What do we do when we hear that someone has done something wrong? How do we go about securing justice? And one of the things that is important for us to remember is there are different types of justice. And particularly, we understand today there are four basic types of justice. The first is retaliatory justice. And that's what happens all the way through the book of 2 Samuel. There are people who do things wrong, and so the way you handle it is you retaliate. And you see where that gets us in 2 Samuel. That's an important practical application. Here's where retaliatory justice leads. to a complete breakdown in social order by the end of the book. And when we take a look at the kinds of ways that we deal today with people who have done wrong, retaliatory justice is very popular. It's popular in churches where people are fighting. It's popular in politics. It's popular all over the place, retaliatory justice. And it just accelerates. And it breaks down everything that's important in our social relationships. Second type of justice is retributive justice. And retributive justice says this person has to be punished as a deterrent to other people doing this or as a deterrent to ever doing it again. And that's retributive justice. There's really not much retributive justice going on in 2 Samuel. It's mostly retaliatory justice. Third type of justice that we see is reparative justice. And this is a kind of justice that's taught in Deuteronomy. It's the kind of justice that's taught in Leviticus. And that is, if you do something wrong, then repair the damage you've done. Take responsibility. If you've hurt somebody, do what you have to do to make it right. It's the kind of justice my parents taught me when I was growing up. You know, if you do something wrong, then you make amends for it. You take responsibility and you make it right. And that's reparative justice. And then the highest form of justice is restorative justice. And it's the kind of justice that Jesus talks about in what it means to love our enemies. Restorative justice means it's how we begin to create the community, put the community back together, how we begin to put our relationships back together again. Because we do have to live together and we have to work together if we want a better world. And that's restorative justice. So from a practical application, 2 Samuel forces us to begin to think about what kind of justice do we want to apply when we see wrongs being done, whether they're things that are happening to us personally, or things happening in a church, or things happening in a community, or in our society as a whole. So, 2 Samuel, I'm glad I'm done with the reading of it. But it's not like Judges. Remember I said Judges is the low point of the Old Testament. There's a lot of bad stuff going on in 2 Samuel. In some ways, it gets just really graphic and turns your stomach. But there's also something else going on in 2 Samuel. There's a wisdom, there's an insight, and there's an understanding about dysfunctional families and dysfunctional politics and what it is that we might do to be able to live differently.